The Senate Education Committee for Friday, March 16th will come to order. We have five bills on the agenda, and the first one is Senate File 451, Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe if I could also ask if Mr. Schoenfeld would be come up and join me. Senate File 451 was a bill dealing with career and technical education. And members, as you remember, it did a couple of things. The discussion that we had, it tried to address a couple of different issues. One part of the bill related to the outcome of last year's special session and how we would treat the career and technical programs and credits. And the other part of the bill actually dealt with the levy, and that too was an outcome of the special session last year, where it was the intent, I think, at least earlier on in the year, to have the levy, career and technical levy, be continuous. And what happened in the special session was that provision was that it would only be for, I believe, 1 year versus ongoing. So the levy part of the bill, I have an amendment. Maybe this would be a good time to offer that amendment. It's the A4 amendment. And what this amendment does is to divide out the levy part, and then maybe the committee would so desire to send that to the tax committee, because that's a issue that the tax committee will have to deal with. And then an amendment, a verbal amendment, was put on when we talked about this bill before, and that verbal amendment added a phrase that says a district approved course, and what I would like to do would be to take that out, because I think we were bringing in another issue that relating to Algebra 2 that actually kind of clouds the issue of what the purpose of this bill really was. So, Madam Chair, the A4 amendment basically does that. It eliminates the language on relating to a district approved course, and then also divides the levy portion out.
How does that work? I mean, what do you think send to the tax committee, though?
Is there any discussion on the amendment?
Madam Chair?
Mr. Nolan.
I thought maybe a little bit of clarification might be helpful as a reminder for members that Senator Stump last year introduced Senate File 451. Subsequently, some of the language was adopted in the final negotiations last year. And so Senator Stump then brought in this year the A2 amendment, which, as he described, added the stricken its equivalent on line 1.2, and then added the district approved course, as well as made some changes to the levy provisions that were part of last year's negotiation. In addition, in the last committee meeting, Senator Stumpf added the A3 amendment, which was an amendment to the A2 amendment, And then today, the A4 amendment makes further changes to the A2 amendment, primarily eliminating the language change on line 1.20 of the A2 amendment, and then eliminating the levy provisions and adjusting the title. So if this amendment were approved, that would leave Section 1 as amended by the A3 amendment as what's left in the bill. So it would leave it a policy bill without any levy adjustments.
Any further discussion on the A4 amendment? If not, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, thank you. Thank you, committee members. There is one other amendment that I'd like to offer to try to clarify the issue that is left in the bill, or the issue that we're trying to deal with, and that is the A5 amendment. And members, I have to apologize that there's so many amendments to try to clarify what we're really trying to do. But the A5 amendment, I will ask Mr. Schoenfeld to try to bring us kind of a succinct understanding of what we're trying to do, and I hopefully will be clear by the time we get done here.
Mr. Schoenfeld.
Madam Chair, my name is Jerry Schoenfeld. I work with the Minnesota Association of Agricultural Educators, and we've been working on this for a number of years, trying to kind of further refine over several steps this intent of the legislature as it refers to current technical courses and their relationships to some of the science requirements that have been imposed over the years. As most of you probably have recognized from previous discussions we've had about this, that different students have different ways of being able to learn, and that Career and Tech offers an opportunity to learn many sciences in a slightly different way than you might get in a regular chemistry or physics course, but nonetheless provides great opportunities for this type of education. I guess if you look at the total structure of what is in the state statutes, you have to recognize that there are two different distinct pieces. And I think this comes out of a tradition that probably goes way back to a little different look in the fact that on the one hand, we have a section of law that deals with standards and benchmarks. On another part of the law, a page later actually in the statutes, we have course requirements. For most of us that have been around a long time, course requirements are the thing that you probably first ran into as you grew up, that there were certain course requirements that were required by the state in order to graduate. When you look at the standards and benchmarks section of the law, there are a couple of places in which course requirements are embedded in the law, but they're in sections that deal with benchmarks and standards. Probably not the best place that they could have been put in the first place. However, much of this education statute has been built over the years kind of like my house. We started out with a 724-square-foot house, and I added on it three times. And as it changed, the intent maybe was a little cloudy from time to time as to where we were going with it. And that's a little bit what's happened with these statutes. So what we attempted to do here was, when the bill was before you a couple of weeks ago, there was a requirement that had come out of the conference committee last summer, which stated that it would be chemistry or physics with the underlying standards of those courses. That wasn't quite what we had in mind going into that conference committee from the standpoint that there are many interdisciplinary career and tech courses where you may learn chemistry, physics, biology, and other things as all part of the course. So what we attempted to do a few weeks ago was to say in the standards and benchmarks section of the statute to say that it would be chemistry, physics, or a career and tech course that met the underlying underlying chemistry, physics, biology, or combinations thereof in a chemistry, in a career and tech course. Since that time, there's been some discussion, and people have been a bit confused because the course requirements, which are in the standards and benchmark section of the law, which requires, for instance, chemistry and physics as a course requirement for graduation, are not mentioned in the course requirements in the section of the law that deals with course requirements. So what we've done here is basically put it in both places. To try and make it a little less confusing, that we understand that the third science-based career and tech class as such is intended to provide the opportunity or option to replace either the chemistry or physics requirement as a course required, but at the same time that be a science-based course that incorporates standards from chemistry, physics, or biology and combinations thereof. And so that's basically what you've got before you. We also made one other change that said rather than meets the standards underlying, maybe it's a little wordsmithing, we're not sure how much effect that has, but we said utilize standards associated with. In other words, the purpose of this is not to make a career in tech instructor into a chemistry or physics instructor. That is not the purpose. The purpose, however, is to provide an alternative in which a student gets science-based career and tech programs, like a health science class as an example, or an agri-science class, where they will learn those concepts before they are out of the course, but at the same time meet the intent, I guess, of the legislature. And so it's an attempt to clarify legislative intent, and I guess with that, Madam Chair, you have to probably state what the intent is, but from our standpoint, that's what we're attempting to do here. And we also recognize that this may not be the silver bullet, and we may have to continue the discussion on this with the department and others to determine exactly what they need in order to fully understand the intent of the legislature, but this is our attempt to do so by placing it into both sections. There is a requirement at the present time in the standards and benchmark section that says by 2014 that a student would have to take chemistry or physics. And so we've placed that in there, and we've said that the career and tech courses have the opportunity to fulfill that requirement.
Are there any questions on the amendment? I think Mr. Schoenfeld has described it quite clearly, that sometimes we do need to put things in more than one place in statute. We did that last year on our literacy. We had our requirement for proficiency by third grade and using scientific research-based in our teacher preparation in areas affecting that. And we also, last year, we added it over into the curriculum and instruction side, so that it wasn't lost, you know, as people are looking in one area, miss the intent in another. The other reality is that, you know, we've had several discussions on the subject that we essentially have paid lip service over the years to the, and not that's not maybe not totally fair, the idea that young people learn in different ways and are challenged in different ways and motivated. And Senator Stumpf and I and others have kind of seen the burden that as we have placed greater and greater emphasis on academic standards and the academic model for learning these subjects, we have lost ground with some of the applied areas. And there are young people that learn better. You know, if we analyze it ourselves, I think we would find, I certainly am one that learns far better when I'm doing something with it and I'm applying it than I do in just a pure form. I can fall asleep real fast just kind of trying to read straight stuff and trying to ingest it in a way that will be useful. And yet, when students have an opportunity to use math, you know, learn science when they see it operative in our lives and in our world, that it turns them on to science and math. And I think can whether it's learning it all that way or if they become motivated to take another course to get in depth as they're in high school. It came home to me when just a week or so ago when we had Senate File 1531 up on the Career and Tech younger tonight we had the 9th and 10th grade discussion that but we left the 10th graders being able to take a course at a tech school that we got some new data that shows that young people who have taken the equivalent of an hour a day for a year in a career tech program in high school. Now, that may have been packaged differently than that, but it's that equivalent, had a 97.12 graduation rate. And if it kind of reinforced what we've been saying all along, is that our graduation rate has been declining instead of increasing, and it may well be because we've been trying to force more young people into a mold of learning that they were not made for or adept at, and they lose interest and absolutely give up. And so this is one of those measures of trying to both the combination of that, and hopefully we will get somewhere with our levy some additional resources to our schools to be able to continue to offer these programs, because we've lost a lot of them in a lot of schools, to be able to maintain and continue them so that young people will have that opportunity to learn in an applied way, at the same time as being able, hopefully opening the door where a lot of the programs and the equipment are located in our tech schools around the state. So this is a time, you know, we're talking about jobs. We hear about people aren't being prepared appropriately or adequately for the jobs. We can talk about that generically, but I think it's our job to look at it and kind of bring it down to brass tacks to see how our policies and our statutes are either getting in the way of achieving that or how we can make them turn around and be not only helpful to the learning of our young people, but also in response to the needs of the workforce and their potential for having a good job into the future. And that can mean more higher education, but if they give up at high school, sometimes they don't get around to getting back, and they lose ground for a long time, if not for the rest of their life. So that's my pitch on this, and I appreciate Senator Stumpf working on this, and we may need to have we run into a little challenge where, you know, you have people working in the department that can see life from one perspective or another, and we're trying to bridge that gap and make it clear what our policies are, what we're wanting to do with our policies to open those doors and keep these options available for students. So. Anyway, thank you, Senator Stumpf, for your work on this. And is there any further discussion on this amendment?
Madam Chair, I also want to thank the staff for their ability to help us out.
Wonderful. If not, Senator Stumpf moves that. Let's see. Now we've got to move the A5 amendment to Senate File 451. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. And so now we have Senate File 451, which, as amended, Senator Stumpf moves to be recommended to pass, and it will be sent to general orders on the before the full Senate. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Same sign, the motion prevails and the bill is passed. Thanks, Senator Stumpf.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and committee members.
Okay, you want to take it one ahead?
No.
Okay. Senator Hahn, I believe, is on his way here, so that will be Senate File 2113.
If not, I will say it. Madam Chair.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since Senator Cruz and I are here, would you be willing to hear us, one of us, while we wait?
Well, why not? Because I don't know. Sometimes being on the way down means you get stopped by a few people along the way. So, Senator Cruz, Senate File 1621. Thank you, Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was thinking about making a motion that we have committee outside today, since this is the Education Committee. Maybe do a little a field trip and sit out on the mall area there. It's so beautiful. But since we're inside, today before you, I have Senate File 1621. Very briefly, what this does is we currently have in statute lists of names for accrediting organizations that get a multiplication factor benefit. So what we're doing here is we are replacing those names with a specific set of criteria, making the process a little bit broader, a little bit more open. The reason we're before the Education Committee today is because the legislation directs the Commissioner of Human Services with the Commissioner of the Education and Health to develop a application process moving forward for approval of this accreditation. But we do also lay down a very specific framework, although be it a broad framework, on which to do that. Some of the different to be an accrediting organization under this legislation, some of the different things that we're looking for here, if you look on line 1.20, the primary one is positive interactions between adults and children, age-appropriate learning activities, a system of tracking children's learning, use of assessment to meet children's needs, specific qualifications for staff, a learning environment that supports developmentally appropriate experiences for children, health and safety requirements, and finally, family engagement strategies. This is all under the more broad criteria of that the accrediting organizations must demonstrate and promote physical, social, emotional, and cognitive development of children. So essentially with that, Madam Chair, that's the legislation, and I would stand for any questions.
Are there any questions of of Senator Cruz? Is there any, do you have anybody testifying to the
Madam Chair and members, I have a couple of folks here to answer questions, but if there are none, we can be quick.
Is there anybody who wishes to testify either for or against this legislation? So it is establishing the components and criteria for accrediting agencies for child care.
Yes, Madam Chair, and then it's directing the different agencies to come back to the legislature with a bit more of a specific process to get folks to meet that criteria, and that process has to be completed by February 15th of 2013, at which point the names that are in statute right now would have to go through that process and then be taken out of statute.
Okay, thank you. Is there any further discussion? If not, Senator Cruz moves that Senate File 1621 be recommended to pass. Whoops, has it been, it's as a, Senator Hahn.
Madam Chair.
Does that need to go to another committee?
Well, I'm wondering if it needs to be in our Health and Human Services Committee.
Again, it was there before. It was amended.
Does this amendment do anything that would change the conditions in which it left? Does it have finance implication, for example?
Madam Chair and Senator Hahn, this is the same language that left the Health and Human Services Committee. We didn't amend it in committee today.
Thank you.
Okay. So it recommended to, as amended, be, well, it's not amended in this committee, so it's
recommended to pass
and,
to the floor.
And sent to the floor for general orders.
Okay. Madam Chair, I apologize for being maybe a little late on the mark here. The fiscal note on this bill was completed on the 22nd. It carries of February. There's a $78,000 fiscal impact in the human services side of the equation, and there's about $1 million of tail on it. There's nothing for the Department of Education here. So my only point of raising that is there a need for finance to look at it? And I simply don't know the answer to that.
Madam Chair, I can speak to that if you'd like. Madam Chair and members, that fiscal note, as you mentioned, Mr. Nauman, was done on the 22nd. That was before we significantly amended the legislation in Health and Human Services. And after that, after speaking to the department, there is no fiscal note in any department moving forward after the amended version.
Thank you. Thanks for clarifying that. Not to, Senator Cruz renews his motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the Senate file 1621 is passed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. Senator Hamm?
We're moving.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And this is a bill, Senate File 2113, that was in this committee just a couple of days ago. And we did have a fairly, I thought, productive discussion about the provisions in the bill. This is charter school authorization, I guess, updates or trying to create some better language for things and move our charter school authorizer process forward. In the course of that hearing, we had a little bit of a discussion about some of the provisions and a need to maybe find some compromise language. And my understanding is that the two parties involved in that discussion have reached an agreement on language that is in the A2 amendment. And so, Madam Chair, if possible, I'd like to offer the A2 amendment and perhaps have Mr. Piccolo speak to what that does and how it accomplishes, addresses the issues that were raised at the last hearing.
Mr. Piccolo.
Madam Chair, members, one of the concerns on page 9, one of the concerns that Senator Nelson raised was an appeal process when decisions were made. And so on page 9, line 25 and 26, what's proposed is to put a comma after renewal, eliminate the word or, put a comma after termination, and then put an appeal process of such termination. So that the appeal process would be between the authorizer and the school, and it could be different for different authorizers depending on how they want to set that up with their schools. On page 9, also, the other section about the dispute resolution process, there was discussion about the cost of that and so forth. So there's language on line 30 to say after the word includes at least the following, and then eliminates points 3 and 4, subpoints 3 and 4 on lines 34, 35. So basically, it just says there's a review dispute resolution process that includes a written notice, a time response, and a process for final resolution.
Madam Chair, question on that?
Senator Bob.
Senator Hand, does this language that we're referring to now, is this now agreed to by the person who raised the concern last time?
Madam Chair and Senator Bonhoff, my understanding is that it does. I have not was not a part of the discussion where that was reached, but I'm being assured that it was, and I believe that's true.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, and then on page 11, to clarify, as we looked at that particular provision, to say on lines 29-30, to clarify that it's an authorizer may not assess a fee for any services required other than provided in the subdivision, just to make a little broader clarification of the law there. And then on page 14, to clarify, one of the concerns was around shopping of potential authorizers, and this language would say that the only transfers are mutually agreed upon transfers are at the end of a contract and with the agreement of the current authorizer. So this would eliminate people shopping around for authorizers in between contract, during a contract, and make it very clear that it's there has to be consent by the current authorizer to move forward on that.
Nelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You might have missed this, or I might have missed this while I stepped out a moment, but I wanted to thank Senator Hand and Mr. Piccolo for the language on line 9.26 about the appeal process. I think that's an example, again, of the committee process working well. We identified an issue, and the stakeholders got involved and have come up with some good language here. So thank you for taking care of that.
Senator
Hand? And Madam Chair, if the amendment meets with the approval of the committee, I again would renew the motion that, or make the motion that the A2 amendment to Senate File 2113 be adopted.
Is there any further discussion on the amendment? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
And Madam Chair, as I said, we did have a fairly lengthy discussion on this bill in this committee the other evening. I do, however, want to note, I was just made aware prior to coming to the table, actually, that the department has written a memo. I have not received that memo, but Mr. Piccolo shared it with me briefly that there were concerns being raised by the department. I have not been made aware of those concerns. And I just want to acknowledge that there apparently are concerns. In fairness to the department and to the committee, if you haven't been made aware of that, I was just made aware of it. I don't know exactly what those concerns are.
Is there somebody here from the department that would like to address it?
And Madam Chair, I would also just say that the bill being introduced in February, I've not heard anything since then until today.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Darren Cordy. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Education. We did send Senator Han an email on Wednesday the 14th. I know Senator Han gets many emails like all of you do, so I certainly would understand if he didn't get it. We'd be happy to go through this with him as the bill continues to move forward. I think we need to verify with our folks whether or not this amendment addresses those concerns.
Okay.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Hand?
My understanding is that this bill is moving forward in the other body. It may not be in the exact form that we have here, so it is likely that this process would continue after the committee would move the bill. And all I will agree to, obviously, is to continue to work with the department to try as best we can to address their concerns within the spirit of what the bill is trying to accomplish.
Thank you. And you're here for the department. I don't know if this, anything has changed, but your fiscal note shows that somehow this would require another full-time equivalent person on staff at the department. And perhaps you could point out what processes are involved here that would require that.
Madam Chair, members, if I may, I'd like to ask Cindy Murphy, who is our Director of Charter Schools, to come up and address that for you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Cindy Murphy, and I'm the Charter Center Director at the Minnesota Department of Education. Thank you for this opportunity. As we looked at the bill as proposed, there were some changes in the role of the department in certain aspects. There was a provision to produce a review and comment when an authorizer wished to expand a charter school. to do a review and comment on the potential merger of two charter schools, as well as a review and comment when a transfer or a change of authorizer request would be submitted. Currently, other than the merger of two charters, which does not currently exist in the charter bill, the department has an approval process. And so one of the pieces that went into the fiscal note is that we would have to develop a process for review and comment that would be conducted when the authorizer would submit the different requests that I just mentioned.
It seems to me that what you would do would be quite similar if you were evaluating a proposal for approval. This is just changing and saying we're not having the department be in an approval mode, but rather having reviewed it to comment on it. Back to the authorizer, who is the one that the legislature has established that process, is the primary overseer and supervisor, if you will, of the charter school. So how would that require that much difference in terms of an additional staffing?
Madam Chair, thank you. Part of that is that we're unsure about the exact nature of review and comment. That could be expansive or it could be minimal. And so while we don't know exactly how much time it would take, you are correct in that our current procedure to review according to our standards in the affidavit or change of authorizer request, that work would be replaced by the function of review and comment. However, we would have to develop the procedure for making review and comment.
Is there any, Mr. Bickle?
Madam Chair, I think the intent is that the process they do to review and comment, to review it, is just the same process. They just make the comment, put it in writing, which they are required to do by law now anyway, and give it to the authorizer, and the decision then, final decision, is the authorizer's rather than the department's.
Madam Chair, I've spoken to Mr. Piccolo about this. I think that is correct. There was not an anticipation of being additional cost, but simply different decision maker. And again, I'm not aware of any costs associated with this bill, and this is the first I've heard of it. So,
thank you. Are there any questions of members? Thank you very much. If there are no further questions, Senator Hahn renews his motion for passage of Senate File 2113 as amended. And does it have to go to the, it will probably need to go to the Finance Committee.
Do we need to refer to Finance?
Is because of the fiscal note being what it is, we'll have to continue to grapple with that. I think it's understood here what the meaning of that is, but I suspect Senator Robing would like to have a look at that too, right, if you don't mind. Great. So it will be re-referred to the Senate Finance Committee. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank
the
you.
The bill is adopted.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
So, who is Senator over here?
She needs to call.
Senator Torres Ray?
Madam Chair, members, thank you so much for the opportunity to present this bill. It feels good to be here, to be able to present this. And members and Madam Chair, this is Senate File 1118 is really a product of hard work in the community and perhaps the result of multiple conversations that took place in Minneapolis for several years. I remember several conversations that took place in my own district where I have a couple of empty buildings that we have not been able to sell or use that belong to the district, and many people began to question why is that we don't partner with charter schools and let them use those buildings. And so as a result of those conversations, we began to really think about what is that we need to do. How do we encourage our district and the different groups that we're working with charter schools in our districts to collaborate with each other and to really look at new ways of doing business and serving children. So this bill, Madam Chair and members, is the result of really a long-term conversation that the district maintained with several groups. And I am very happy to report to you that, you know, they have come to consensus. People are not completely happy in the district. The charters are not completely happy. The parents are not completely happy because it's hard to please everybody 100%. But what we have in front of you is really a result of long conversations that we think are going to make a difference and are going to give the Minneapolis School District an opportunity to really look at this collaborative effort between chartered schools and the district in a different way. So with this bill, Madam Chair and members, what we will do is really present this opportunity for charter schools to have voluntary collaboration around issues of interest like referendum revenue, special education services, facilities, transportation, education aid payments, etc. So I am very excited about this idea, and people in the district are just really looking forward to see these groups working together with the district and really looking at the future. So with me, I have Jim Grathwell, and I have several people in the community who have worked on this and are here to express their support and really ideas around how Minneapolis kids and families could benefit from this collaboration.
Thank you, Senator Torres-Ray, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jim Grathwell with the Minneapolis Public Schools. I just want to thank you for this opportunity to present the bill. Thank the author for bringing it forward and let you know we have a couple supporters who weren't able to make it into the room today. Eric Mahmood is going to get here as soon as he can, but Mr. Mahmood is strongly in support of the bill. I have our Office of New Schools Director, Sarah Paul, should be very close to the building, if not in the building. So I hope she gets here for backup should there be any tough questions. Charter School Partners is strongly in support of the bill and should be speaking on the bill. I believe the Minnesota School Boards is going to join us at the table. The basic premise of this bill is that our kids do better when we work together. And what the bill does is amends 124D10 to create a new section, 1.05, that allows school districts to collaborate with charter schools. That is school districts that are charter authorizers. So only chartered authorizer school districts are eligible to do this, to voluntarily collaborate and negotiate with the charters that retain complete autonomy. The revenue goes directly to the charter. I think you're going to hear a concern from Mr. Piccolo about that issue. I'm happy for a clarifying amendment that makes absolutely, abundantly, perfectly clear that this is revenue not going through the district, not being retained by the district, but going directly to the charters that are in this collaborative relationship, and that there's no double dipping and, you know, cross our heart and hope to die, stick a needle in my eye. That's the intent of this bill. And if we need to improve the language, I'm happy to make that happen. The goal here is work with strong partners in a voluntary fashion to resolve that the issues that have stood between charters and regular districts for so long. Special education tuition billing, referendum revenue, access to facilities. We believe in this relationship, by classifying our collaborative charter partner enrollment as pupil units of the Minneapolis Public Schools, they should get access to referendum revenue. They should get access to the facilities we own and operate. So, and essentially, we should be able to support them around their education aids payment shift issues. Ultimately, we're stronger working together to support the success of all children. This is our best effort to support the work we're already doing with Mr. Mahmood in terms of a long-range plan to replicate some of his successful schools in Minneapolis. And that's done with a reform-minded superintendent and a reform-minded board. But I don't believe the work is sustainable unless we make these changes that allow us to collaborate together on the issues I've mentioned. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have or bring other witnesses to the table.
Why don't we, I don't know if people have questions right now, Senator Daley, but the rest we'll have your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one quick question. Does the charter have the full authority to determine the hiring of its faculty?
Madam Chair, Senator Daley, again, full autonomy. The full autonomy to hire, fire, the employer of record is the nonprofit board that is the charter school, not the Minneapolis Public Schools. The employees are employees of the nonprofit charter.
Madam Chair, the reason I ask is because in the proposed legislation, it doesn't appear absolutely clear to that point. Okay. So,
Madam Chair,
we want to work on that to clarify that.
Madam Chair and Senator Daley, what I tried to do was pull into this. I could have taken another tack. I could have amended 124D10, and it would have been a much shorter bill. Instead, I brought provisions of 124D10 into this legislation. So I've replicated all the employment-related components of 124D10 that grant that autonomy and authority and that the employment status of the but if there needs to be an improvement in that, I'm happy to. The Minneapolis Public Schools, as the originator of the proposal, and I think charter school partners and other folks on the bill who support it, that's the intent, that we want full autonomy of the charter in employment and other issues. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Daley.
As Senator Torres-Ray has sat in on the opposite side here, it's kind of fun to be asking the questions as she's sitting up there, and I look forward to working with her on improving this legislation as it moves along to its next step.
Senator, Madam Chair, if I may, as I listen to Mr. Grattle, I listen to his conversation with Mr. Piccolo, I feel like, well, they haven't contacted me to talk about this. So, Senator, I would be more than happy to work with you. And definitely that's the intent. And we want to make absolutely sure that your concerns are you know, reflected in here, because that the intent is really to give these entities the opportunity to collaborate and do the work without really stepping into each other's toes. So we ask these questions. I ask the questions. I will be happy to work with you. And Mr. Grath will work with you and I to make sure that that's reflected here if we need to.
So I haven't had a chance to study this in great depth, but could you help me understand what's different from the structure, the governance structures we have now? We have the charter school governance. We have site governed schools that even are possibly developing within your district. I know Mr. Mahmood, there was some agreement reached that there might be actually some replication of a very successful endeavor, and I've often wondered, we've done these things, why aren't people paying attention when they're getting the student achievement with the very populations that we're having concern about? Why isn't somebody trying to figure out what's going on and replicating it? And it looks like there are some steps in that direction that could operate under the charter. What's different? What's the barrier to the current structures we have that you're creating a whole new structure?
Madam Chair, I'm going to let Mr. Grattle go into detail, but clearly what we see in the district right now is that current policies prevent in some ways to really have the district collaborate in significant ways with charter schools on, kind of using buildings, for instance, figuring out how do we collaborate with staff. We could do this. It's not that we are completely limited from that. But what this does is that it puts in policy the idea that it is allowed, that they're going to engage in that conversation, and that actually, it is kind of the expectation that they do collaborate. And I think that was part, you know, with the vacant buildings, there was a lot of animosity around, you know, whether the district could use these buildings and could make, you know, a decision on their own to invite charter schools or not and do contracts. And what these will do is my understanding that it will give you that flexibility, and it's kind of part of the policy process that the district will engage in, and it's a given that they will collaborate. But maybe you can talk about other specifics.
So, Senator Torres, are you telling me that Minneapolis it won't do the things that it could do, and so we're having to create new law to try to make them do that?
Madam Chair and members.
Maybe that's not kind.
No. But, Madam Chair and members.
Mr. Grethel.
It's a great question. Why have the bill? I would just, as a school board governed by elected individuals, and with all of you having election certificates, I think you may recognize or be sensitive to this, they feel their fiduciary responsibilities are to the students of the Minneapolis Public Schools, the students who are enrolled in the Minneapolis Public Schools. By law, under current law, when anyone charters a school, they no longer are members of the they're not enrolled students of the Minneapolis Public Schools. I believe this bill corrects what, in my mind, is a public policy defect in our charter law, but we're not correcting that. We're correcting it in a separate section of statute. Anyone who likes the current statute can work and continue to do that. This simply allows an autonomous charter to be have enrolled pupils in the serving district, and then when those pupils are considered enrolled pupils of the Minneapolis Public Schools, the elected board, I think, can treat and negotiate and collaborate with a much more open hand with respect to facilities, referendum revenue. I think we can work on the issues of tuition billing or tuition provision of special ed services. And you should know our history, and I think the senator made some allusion to it. After a period of closing a number of schools, we went to repurpose the building, and a previous board specifically said, we're having an RFP, but we are not interested in having any charters take any of these buildings. Previous board, previous situation. Since then, we have co-located charters in our schools, We have sold schools to charters. And I think what we're seeing is kind of on both sides of the aisle, as it were, in the charter sector in Minneapolis and in the district sector, a greater interest at looking at each other as collaborative partners that strengthen the effort to, in our language, make all kids college and career ready or close the achievement gap. You know, we're all actually on the same team. The bill we're proposing or brought before you today, and you're graciously hearing, allows us to collaborate, the adults to collaborate in the best interest of the kids, sharing everything we bring to the table. Not double dipping, charters can retain autonomy, charters receive the same flow of revenue, but more revenue gets put on the table and facilities get put on the table, and I believe greater support. And if Mr. Mahmood was here, he would talk a little bit about, you know, he could use a little downfield blocking so we can support the work that he's doing. Madam Chair, was that an adequate answer?
Well, in part, I still have to grapple with this, maybe we need to hear some more.
Right. The final point I'd make would be the efforts of this board and this superintendent, I think, are courageous. But in the end, under current law, will as we replicate charter schools with Mr. Mahmood or other charter schools, we're shrinking our enrollment base and reducing our revenues. And I think it's a courageous and reform-minded superintendent and board that would lead the district in that direction. To keep that sustainable, I think I would prefer to have this legislation, need to have that legislation. So you can continue to foster districts and charters working together for the best interests of students.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the existing law on converting existing schools change How is your proposal different from, let's say, the existing law when it talks about converting existing school district facilities to a charter?
Right. Madam Chair, Senator Stumpf, I got the current law in front of me, and I don't know it by heart, but I recall it's a 60% vote of teachers. So that, I mean, the 124D.10, including that conversion piece, remains in statute. I don't know that that's ever been exercised. So teachers could, at any school, including in Minneapolis, vote to convert themselves into a charter. But then again, those students that attended that school, if this is the city of Minneapolis, under current law, would open enroll out into that new charter. So that still operates. And, you know, my bargaining unit just got approved as an authorizer of charter schools, the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers. So, you know, a lot of people are interested in working in that sector.
And, Madam Chair, one other question is, have you addressed the whole issue of the athletics? So that'll be a collaborative, too?
Madam Chair and Senator Stumpf, the current law has the collaborative sponsorship. Is that the term? Cooperative sponsorship is the term through high school league sports. But I think that gets put on the table as well. I think the secret sauce in this proposal is that under a collaborative, a voluntary collaborative charter proposal with any district under this, any charter authorizer approved district, the Board of Education has to look at the enrolled pupils of the charter as their pupils, and then a bunch of keys, you know, that turns the key in a number of locks. That the sports piece, I think you negotiate and work out all the other elements. You know, it's a community of mutual interest then. Yeah. Would it mean there would never be bills on that back up here? I can't promise that, Senator.
Let's hear some more testimony.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. Madam Chair.
So I have with me, let me see if I can ask Mr. Al Fan to come and testify. And I don't know who else is here. I don't know if there are some people who were coming, so I don't know who is here. Sarah Paul, I don't know if she's here. Who's here, Jim?
I'll go look for her.
Okay,
right now.
But please go ahead.
Yep.
Yes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Al Fan. I'm the executive director for a nonprofit organization called Charter School Partners. We are a young nonprofit funded with local and national dollars with the mission of improving public education through high-quality charters. And one of our areas of focus is to close the achievement gap, specifically in Minneapolis. We are here to support this bill because as a member of a national group of cities called C-Trust, we are beginning to see more and more cities take on this collaborative nature. What I like about this bill is that it really formalizes this collaboration that Senator Torres Ray is talking about, and it really starts to change the dialogue from an us-them to a we. One of the cities that we visited recently as part of the Compact Initiative was Denver. And Senator Nelson was with us, and Senator Harrington was with us on this trip. And I think what we saw there was a wonderful example of how district and charter schools work very closely together to accomplish the one goal of improving education results for all kids in the city, regardless of this type of school, the governance model. The overarching goal in Denver is to serve the kids with the best education. And I think we all want that in Minneapolis as well. But what this bill does is start to formalize the incentive structure for the district to start serving all schools in Minneapolis, regardless of the type of school. There are currently about 40 charter schools in Minneapolis. They represent about 20% of the student population, the publicly enrolled student population in Minneapolis. And what we're starting to see now is we need to keep moving the bar. We need to keep improving the quality of those charter schools in Minneapolis so that we can improve the academic outcomes for all of our kids. What this bill does, I think, is provide incentives to charter schools to work more closely with the district so that they can get access to facilities, get access to financial resources, get access to developmental resources that the district has. And more specifically, there was a conversation about the referendum dollars. One of the things, I would say the two things that hold charter schools back most of the time are facilities and dollars. And this bill tries to address both of those. It doesn't require any exchange of facilities or dollars, but it does provide a high level of incentive for the Minneapolis Public School District to start offering those to charter schools in return for higher performance. Let me just go back to the compact for a second. The compact was a grant competition sponsored by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They identified 16 cities around the country who are working together to build this collaborative relationship between the district and charters. Minneapolis was one of the cities selected to be in that grant competition. And I think the process that we went through really showed that this superintendent, Bernadette Johnson, is very much supportive of reform in the district, very supportive of high-quality charter schools, and very supportive of serving all kids in the city regardless of the model of school. Our specific role in this is that we, as a nonprofit, are supporting charter schools like Harvest Prep and Hiawatha Leadership Academy and Minneapolis College Prep, which are all partner schools and all schools in the city. We're supporting them to get better and to continue to deliver high outcomes. But we are also incubating new charter schools in the city as well. So we offer a fellowship program that results in new charter schools in Minneapolis. We work very closely with the Walton Family Foundation, which provides funding for startup charter schools. And we believe that by bringing all of these resources and aligning them in Minneapolis and focusing on high quality outcomes, we can continue to work to improve the outcomes for all kids.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Whatever you and the committee prefer, we have some people who have extended support. We have letters of support from MNCAN, the Minneapolis Foundation, the Minnesota School Boards Association. We have, how are you? Thank you. So if you would like to hear from them, they are here. But, I know you're pressing for time, so you let me know. We have one more person who's here now.
Okay. Hello, Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Paul. I'm the director for the Office of New Schools in the Minneapolis School District. Eric Mahmoud and I were hoping to be presenting together today. Unfortunately, he had a meeting that he was unable to reschedule. So he did draft this letter, and I would like to read this to you because I think it represents the full commitment from our superintendent to really focus on quality across Minneapolis and really looking to identify partners that have achieved what we hope to accomplish in our schools. So I'll make this available to you, and I will just start to read this. Dear Senators, I write this letter in support of Senate File 1185, the District Charter Collaborative Bill. I would have preferred to express my support in person, but due to a previously scheduled meeting, I will not be able to get there in time, so I am sharing my support in writing. North Minneapolis is the epicenter of the nation's largest achievement gap. There were not any schools in North Minneapolis in 2011 that made annual yearly progress, with the exception of Harvest Preparatory School and Best Academy. Harvest Prep and Best went far beyond just making the goal of AYP. It demonstrated in 2011 how to close the achievement gap. We specifically desire to partner with Minneapolis Public Schools to replicate the success of Harvest Preparatory School and Best Academy across Minneapolis to close the achievement gap. This partnership is possible in large part due to the foresight of an innovative superintendent and a brave board that are prioritizing the needs of students over the financial interests of their own district. It is not reasonable to demand that Minneapolis Public Schools celebrate our success and assist us to continue to succeed without giving them an incentive to do so. Senate File 1185 provides both district and charters a win-win situation for children in Minneapolis by declaring in statute that these are our children. This bill will help Minneapolis Public Schools give priority to the academic needs of all Minneapolis children, regardless of charter or district. Thank you, Eric Mahmoud. And I'm I'll be here to answer any questions that you have from the district perspective.
Great. Thank you. Are there others that want, Mr. Piccolo, do you want to talk about this, or is, Mr. Nathan?
Madam Chair.
I'd like to hear from you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Daley.
Madam Chair, as they approach, I'm looking at this more and more. I have further questions. There's a couple that come to mind right away. One's pretty easy, and I'd like to follow it up with a second question. Will the school district serve as the authorizer in this situation? It's not clear the language to me.
I believe. Go ahead and answer the question.
Madam Chair, Senator Daley, the line 1.9, the board is subject to the requirements for charter school authorizers under 124D.10. So, Madam Chair and members, this provision, this collaborative charter school only works for school districts that are authorizers, approved by MDE as authorizers.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair, the follow-up question is, it appears clear that the money is going to flow to the district. There's no double dipping, and he said, cross my heart, hope to die, poke a needle in my eye. I promise you it's going to be there. What advantages do these arrangements offer the students or charter? What are the advantages to this? Why can't we amend the current charter school statutes to give authority to school boards and charter schools to work together?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Daley.
Go ahead.
I think that's what we are doing, but you know, as I have done this work with my school board and with members of the charter community, there's a history of, I'll just say there's trust issues that, we're warranted due to past behavior, and I think we're trying to improve our behavior on both sides and move on. What this does is, I could have amended 124D.1, and it would have been a much shorter bill. But in my initial efforts to work with folks in the charter community, they seem to want me to focus my efforts elsewhere, not mess with their statute. So I tried to replicate the provisions of 124D.1 in another section of statute, and that's why you have the bill in front of you. I think the benefit to, again, all this really does is allow the school board in a collaborative mutual relationship to consider the pupils enrolled in the charter that they're collaborating with as their own pupils, and then again, that's the key that unlocks district assets and support for that charter.
So if you have a high performer, it can bring your numbers up. A question relative to because there's been a bill floating around. I don't know that we've heard it, and I've had a swimming with all the things going on, but of allowing referendum revenue to pass through to the charters as well, which a lot of the districts don't like. But this is a way that the district will be able to count the charter school members in their ability to collect referendum revenue, the membership on which they will collect referendum revenue. Will that pass through to the – will that stay with the district, or will that referendum revenue go to the charter school?
Madam Chair and members, that's a great question. I think when the Board of Education sees let's presume the bill passes. We have a new section of law. The district can enter into a collaborative relationship with charter schools. Those charter school pupil units are their pupils. I think the Board of Education will look at those pupils and the revenue they generate, and the board should, that's the whole point of negotiating, you should send that revenue to that school. The current law denied charters access to referendum revenue, but gave them the tuition billing piece and the extra transportation mandate. So the goal here is to have everything on the table, referendum revenue and tuition, transportation and facilities, and protection from the education aid's payment shift. Really, I think of those as the five things we have to talk about. Those are the five things that get, and I'm sure there's more, but those are the financial issues that should be negotiated among and between the collaborative charter and the district board.
And Madam Chair, if I may, I said in the beginning, really, in an ideal world, we should be able to do this, and we should be able to work on this. The size of our district and the complexity of our district has put this kind of efforts to kind of come together and work together in very difficult circumstances. You know, there are parents in our district who really are opposed to any conversations that take place between the district and charter schools. And then there are other groups who really want the district to pay more attention because they, you know, they value what the charter schools are doing for their kids. So we have these polarizing views in our district many times, and the district has been put kind of in the middle of it multiple times. You know, transportation was a huge conversation in our district. Facilities was a huge conversation in our district. And this particular one, referendum revenue, is a very big conversation. And we find many times, you know, people in very opposite sides. What I'm hoping this will do is that this will bring us together. Now, it is a test. And, Madam Chair, I said at the very beginning of this presentation, this is not perfect. What has happened in my district, though, is that, you know, if in a political given year one group is louder than the other, they rule. And then we don't get anything done. And what we have in the district going on right now is that we have amazing charter schools that are doing tremendous progress with kids that are not, you know, that face very challenging situations. They need to be supported. So we need to bring the community together. And, you know, Mr. Piccolo and I had this conversation in my office. I really wanted to do this. I want to bring these groups to work together and to figure out a way. We may find along the way, and I'm making this promise publicly before you and before the public, that we, you know, we might have some problems along the way. I'll come back. I promise you that I will be back before you to fix that, because what we're doing in Minneapolis is really looking for new tools to address significant challenges that we have not been able to address. And so all I'm asking for is an opportunity to just really bring these to the district so that they can begin to collaborate in more meaningful ways and get the work done for our kids.
Well, so, Senator Torres-Ray, I'm not sure it's ready to go to the district, but I'd like to hear from a couple more. We're going to have to wind up this discussion now, but let's get a couple more, and then I think we can maybe pick it up at another time to grapple more with these issues. Mr. Piccolo, would you like to go first?
Madam Chair, members, my name is Eugene Piccolo, Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. We applaud all efforts to find ways to facilitate people and institutions to work together. We also recognize that different institutions have different purposes, structures, and arrangements in terms of achieving that. One of the things that this bill seeks to do is to foster collaboration. And we do have collaboration across the state between charter schools and districts. Senator Stump asked the question earlier about extracurricular activities. We have hundreds of cooperative agreements between charter schools and traditional school districts across the state where students in our high schools participate in their resident district sports activities. We also have co-locations of schools in both public buildings that are owned by government, local governments, and by public school districts. We also have shared arrangements, for example, in Milroy, Minnesota, between the school district and the charter school, where they share administration. The administrator has been historically both the superintendent of the district and the charter school director. So we have had many types of collaboration. In fact, Forest Lake, they have aligned the curriculum in one of the charter elementary schools with the curriculum in the high school so that kids can take 12 years of Spanish. And it's been recognized as one of the most innovative programs in the United States. So there is collaboration going on. While the proposed legislation uses the term collaboration, One has to look at the details to try to understand what that definition is. As you know, Minnesota's charter school law has been ranked nationally as the first or second best law in the country every year based on the 20 essential components of a strong public charter school law. Among the components of Minnesota's score that is the highest are two of the three areas that are considered core principles of public school chartering: accountability and autonomy. The reason for our high ranking in the area of autonomy is that charter schools in Minnesota are fiscally and legally autonomous with independent charter boards. What does autonomy mean? It means that schools have the clear statutory authority to govern all aspects of the school's operations, including to directly receive and disperse funds, enter into contracts, be sued, and all other aspects of being an organization that controls its operations. In some ways, this legislation would move us backwards in terms of autonomy of charter school because the law creates a number of conditions that reduces that autonomy. First, the students would be students of the traditional district, not of the charter school. And under state law, funding goes to the school, the district in which the students are reduced, which means they will not have direct say over their income and disbursements. The traditional district would be the one that receives and then disperses the funds to the schools. So it becomes an intermediary. And we know there's always a cost when there's an intermediary. The traditional district would also receive lease aid, according to the legislation, of the students in the district when the district is already receiving property taxes for the buildings of those students. Even a charter school, if they chose not to lease from the district. In my part of town, that's called double dipping. It has been mentioned that there is a defect in the law. The defect in the law is a philosophical one. If you believe that a charter school students should be counted as students of that school or part of the district, we do not believe that is a defect in our law. In fact, that is the strength and the crowning achievement of our law that every state that has charter school laws is trying to achieve. It has also been mentioned that there has been difficulties with regard to facilities in Minneapolis. And yes, there have. Because at one point, the district published a policy that would not lease empty buildings to charter schools. So if there is problems in the relationship, one has to look at what are the policies that have been put in place to cause some of those feelings. There are also a number of things that are left very vague in terms of the relationship between what is a collaborative charter and the district. Some people have described this proposed arrangement like a marriage contract. From our perspective, if that is the metaphor we're going to use, we believe there needs to be a clear prenuptial agreement that goes with this arrangement. The Minnesota Charter School opposes this legislation as presented, as it's a step backwards from the very foundation of what chartering schools is about and Minnesota's leadership in setting national policy on chartering. One final note. If the intent of this is to foster collaboration, then we can, I believe, simply put one sentence in the law. It is the policy of the state of Minnesota that all public school districts and charter schools must collaborate in terms of direct and indirect services for students and public facilities. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Nathan?
Madam Chair, before...
We're going to have to...
I just wanted to respond to a couple of statements made by this testifier.
That's fine.
You can go ahead and let Mr. Nathan go ahead.
Dr. Nathan. I've been doing it again. Sorry.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator, I want to applaud the efforts of the current administration in the Minneapolis Public Schools to take steps toward the adoption, replication, and expansion of outstanding charters. There are other outstanding charters in Minneapolis, and some of them are not being as treated as well, I'm afraid, as these. But I want to applaud the I want to applaud the efforts on the part of the senator and the district, and I want to say that although there is a lot of history here, and without going through all of it, I think it's important to recognize the history. I don't think numerous charters have tried to rent space from the district in the past. Numerous charters have tried to rent space from have tried to collaborate in terms of athletic teams. And as Mr. Piccolo said, in some places it's been yes, in some places it's been no, and in some places there's been double hockey sticks in front of the no. So I want to say that I think this could be a step forward and raise five specific questions for the authors to consider. And having only heard about this in the last 48 hours in terms of the details, I've had a limited amount of time, but I have five specific suggestions to make in the spirit of collaboration, because I believe, as the representative of the Minneapolis Public Schools said, that this could be in the best interest of many, many youngsters. First, I think it's important to understand that there are a variety of people who pay taxes in Minneapolis, some of whom send their youngsters to the Minneapolis schools, some of them whom who do not. And so if a school board thinks that they should be thinking only about the kids who are a part of the district, I think they ought to think again, because they ought to think about the thousands of people in Minneapolis and in other communities who pay taxes. So some of us have been saying for literally 15 to 20 years, those buildings belong to the people in Faribault, where, by the way, they do in the Faribault district, where they do lease space currently to a charter in that district. They belong to the people of Minneapolis, not just to the kids who go to the district. So I want to encourage some thinking about mindset. It is the board's responsibility to help youngsters in Minneapolis, not just youngsters who go to the district schools. So that's a question of mindset. Secondly, in response to you, Senator, you asked terrific questions, and I want to say to you with respect that it is not clear to me, having worked in legislation in this and 40 other states with the National Governors Association, it is not clear, A, that in the relevant section that the personnel would be decided by the charter. I think that could be improved. I think that could be clarified. I don't think it's impossible to clarify, but I agree with you, sir, that Senator, that that needs some clarification. So personnel is a big issue. Secondly, accountability is a big issue. This committee and its predecessors have spent hours on the issue of charter accountability that has had to be clarified. It's not clear to me who is responsible for the accountability in schools, because it's not clear, going back, Senator, again to a question that you asked, whether all of these schools are going to be authorized by the district in which they are located. There is a question, and I have raised this with Mr. Stewart of the African American Leadership Forum, and I've raised it again with the representative of the Minneapolis schools. I think we need some clarification. If these are schools that are going to be authorized by another organization, but they are located in a district, who is responsible? Again, I don't think that's an insurmountable question, but I think it is a question that needs more attention. Mr. Piccolo talked about the issue of finance. On the one hand, we're told, well, it's going to be good for the district, and on the other hand, we're told, well, all the money will go to the school. So I want to understand the finances, but more importantly, I think the state policymakers ought to understand the finances. If all of the money is going to go to the school, then what's the financial advantage to the district? If all of the money is not going to go, what are the conditions? Because we have alternative schools which have, in many cases, come to this body and said, you know, a lot of money gets sent to the district, but much of it doesn't get to us. And so this is a big issue, and I think it needs further specific clarification. Is there going to be a certain percentage of the money? And some of these things could be negotiated, but some of them, it seems to me, might very well be the subject for public policy. So the third is finance. The fourth is a special education issue. We have 20 years of history, both in terms of open enrollment and the charter idea, that it is the district of residents where the youngster stays who pays for the special ed costs. That precedes the charter movement. It has to do with the open enrollment. It is the responsibility of the district of residents. Are we going to change that? Again, not saying that this is imperfect. I'm saying I think it needs clarification, and I'd suggest some specific clarification on that point. In terms of accountability, who is responsible? In terms of authorization, who is going to be responsible in terms of personnel, in terms of finance, in terms of special education? I think there's critical issues. But having said that, I also want to salute the senator. I also want to salute other groups that have been involved in this. I think this could be an important step forward.
Thank you, Dr. Nathan. Senator Chamberlain.
Just quickly, it says a big step to take, so is it the intent that we'll lay this over so we'll
Yes, we do need to give it more attention. I think the staff has raised some issues here, and The language doesn't conform to some of the changes we made in charter school law last year. And I think, I recently received the kind of the report card on charter states for their charter laws, and we have been number one for the strength of our charter school law. We got bumped this year to number two by Maine because they finally got around to passing one.
Yeah.
But we do have a strong law, and I think we ought to be looking at the implications. Is this another structure? Is this change to our law, or what are the implications? I think we need to know, to determine that. So that would be my intent. Senator Nelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't want to belabor this. I see we're coming at the end, but I wanted to kind of echo some of Dr. Nathan's comments and just add a couple other things that I'd like to know more about before we see this again. Well, first, there were very dynamic charter schools that we visited in Denver. Very exciting. And we would love to see those opportunities for all students. My questions were twofold. One, I wondered about charter lease aid and if these charter schools that are authorized by the Minneapolis School District would be getting both charter lease aid and referendum dollars. And then secondly, I was concerned on a broader issue. Are we creating, if this were to happen, could there be an unintended consequence that we are creating an unlevel playing field for other charter schools that are not offered through a school district? I think that's an important element that I would want more information on. And we don't need to discuss it today if you're trying to wrap up.
Yes.
Thank you.
Senator Bono.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did have the lease aid question. I also wonder about I know we don't do state startup aid anymore, but there's federal startup aid, and so I wonder if the charter schools under this purview would be eligible for that, and again, how does that fit with allowing them to get regular student aid and referendum aid? But then just a broader comment, this is an unusual group coming together to sit at the table. I mean, I haven't seen this before, where Al Fan sits next to, this Minneapolis sits next to the business partnership who's here. And so I would say there is obviously something here that is perhaps the germ of an important step going forward, and I think that's what you were saying, Dr. Nathan, that we shouldn't be too quick to just put it aside, but we should keep the best of what we've learned from charter schools, which was really our intent, is to use charter schools as the laboratory for replication. We have those wonderful charter schools like Harvest Prep, and then how do we take that and scale it up somewhat? And I think in Minneapolis, where we have such a huge problem, the idea of scaling up in collaboration with the district is key. And so we want to make sure that partnership stays strong. So I would, I don't know where this is in the House. It sounds like we've got a way to go here, but I'm really grateful, Senator Torres-Ray, and to all the people who are here today for bringing it forward.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I so much appreciated that you gave me a hearing, because partially, the intent here was to kind of listen to all of you and just kind of bring these ideas together. One thing that I have to say to all of you is that as I hear the testimony, I am reminded of how difficult this is and how every time we bring a new idea, everybody comes forward with kind of a protecting my territory. In these concerns that are being brought to my attention, not one has said we really need to be innovative about making a difference for kids. So the questions are, what are we going to do with teachers? I mean, personnel, we have to protect them. What are we going to do with funding? What are we going to do with our buildings? What are we going to do with our money? And we need to move away from that. I think the idea, and at least my participation in this, has been about really looking for innovative ways. The district has to collaborate with new partners. We have charter schools in our district that have high concentration of high poverty children of color, immigrant children that are just not doing well, and we need accountability. My hope is that if they collaborate with the district, we're going to be able to collect data on these kids and really know what is happening. I don't like that. I don't like what's going on in many of these schools that are not accountable. So I do think that there is an opportunity for us to figure out how do we increase accountability, how do we increase collaboration. And I'm not going to be naive enough to say that, you know, money does not matter, that facilities that do not matter. Of course they do. We manage all of that. But at the end of the day, what we need to ask is, how are our kids doing in both systems, and isn't it time for us to really make them work together for better outcomes? This legislation is only about that, and I intend to work with all of you to bring, you know, Senator Daley, your I will be happy to entertain an amendment. Senator Nelson, you know, I'll be happy to collaborate with you to figure out how do we strengthen this language. Senator Bonoff, I think the question about, you know, federal and startup aid is a very pertinent one, and we need to figure out how that will work. So there are some details that are not here, but I'm very open to working with you to fix that.
Thank you. We have one more bill, and I don't have we lost our author? Is she here? So we do need to go forward. So I will lay this Senate File 1185 on the table.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Senator Ortman. Thank you, Senator Ortman.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for having me in the Education Committee. I don't frequently come here, and in fact, I've needed remedial training in the Tax Committee about the implications and interactions between education finance and taxes, property taxes, in our Tax Committee. And your fiscal analyst, Mr. Nauman, has provided great service to us in the committee as we try and learn about more about what happens between school district referendums and levies and the other property taxes that Minnesotans pay. And so we've been appreciative of his service in the Tax Committee.
Well, thank you, Senator Ortman. We were aware that that you did take advantage of that, and we haven't decided what it's going to cost you yet, but we'll be talking about that.
Well, I hope we won't have to raise taxes to pay for it, Senator. Madam Chair and members, Senate File 2471 is a bill that I introduced many years ago called the Reasonable Referendum Act, and several of the members here were sponsors or have heard this bill before. I believe that Senator Han was a co-author years ago, and Senator Stumpf gave the bill a hearing many years ago, and I appreciated that. And Senator Olson, I believe you were a sponsor as well. It's a issue that I think warrants further attention. What the bill hopes to accomplish is to require that any referendum, other than one where a school district is acting in a statutory operating debt, would be brought on general election day. It seems to me and the folks that I represent that the best day to have any kind of an election to raise funds for a local school district would be on general election day. That's when you get the highest voter turnout. And we've had the experience in our communities where a referendum initiative will fail, and then it will be brought back on an odd day. And if it fails again, it might be brought back in May or September instead of on general election day. And most people expect to vote, and our highest voter turnout is on general election day.
Well, Senator Ortman, if I might just add to your history, I carried the initial legislation that passed and is current law that restricted operating referendum levies elections from being more than once a year, and that was led to also it being scheduled on general election day. The one that wasn't changed was bond.
Correct, and that's what this would do.
Bonding one, and it was left in place if they were on statutory operating debt that they would that they also could do it at another time. So there is a history, and we've taken part of that step. But there were arguments back at that time in terms of the timing of construction seasons and a few other things that why they wanted a little more flexibility on the bond referendum. But and there may be others that have something to say about that. But what your purpose here is not. You recognize that we do have that requirement for our operating referendum, But this will bring the bond referendum to Election Day as well.
Yes, Madam Chair. This is
but
for
you're not trying to do it on just even years. You're just you're it's a general election day each year.
Correct. Any year. Okay. On general election day, however, and I want to give you the example of a recent election, November 8th, 2011, there was a small central Minnesota school district that placed a ballot question on for $13.1 million in bonded debt for the improvement of sites and facilities. It failed on general election day, having received only 428 votes to 554. So it was a 44% to 56% failure. The initiative was brought again 3 months later in February. Far fewer voters in the election, from 982 total votes cast down to 765. And this time, the initiative passed, but by 7 votes. So they gained 7 yes votes by moving the election to 3 months later. So there were 28% more total votes cast in the November election than there were in the February election. I think most people believe that they are asked to come to vote on general election day. I think that the supporters have an advantage in any off election because you've built a base of support, and the folks that are affected with the no aren't following necessarily all of the stories and all of the plans for the school district. And so I think we need to be respectful of those that might want to vote no in a referendum by moving these elections. And so with that, Madam Chair and members, I wanted to tell you just one other recent story that my husband and I experienced when we went and voted absentee. And the reason this is important is because if we change the referendum elections to general election day, there's an added benefit that's not very clear by the language here in this bill, and this is the advantage. We went to vote absentee, and we were told that to vote absentee, we needed to go to the school district to vote. And so we went to the school district, and we were told to go to the administrative offices to cast our ballot in a school referendum for a new technology in the Chanhassen High School. And so we went to the school district offices. We were told to go to the administration offices. There was a school district employee who had piles and piles and piles of ballots. I had to give, as did my husband, our ID to the school district employee, which I thought was more than a little ironic. I received a ballot. I went and I privately voted. My husband did not see how I voted, nor did I see how he voted. But I had to hand the ballot back to the school district employee. And I didn't feel like there was a lot of integrity in that. And so if we move the school district referendums to general election day, already in statute we would have the requirement that only the county auditors could conduct those elections. And so I think there's a second benefit here to passing this legislation. Now, I know the school districts are here, and I'm sure that school board members and others will oppose this, but I hope you'll consider this as a very important measure of voter integrity and ensuring that we have the highest possible turnout when folks are actually voting for property tax increases across their community.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Ortman. I don't know if there are questions or are there folks that would like to testify on either for or against the bill. Ms. Kelleher, would you like to testify?
Madam Chairman and members, I'm Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. I have a handout for the committee. It's this year's bond referendums that have gone forward and how many won and passed, and it's on the side. You can see how many people voted in them and what they look like from around the state.
And what date they occurred?
Yes, what date they occurred and for what purpose they were asked for. So hopefully that can give you some clarity. We can provide you back your information, but I thought maybe this year might be helpful to the committee. Madam Chairman, MSBA opposes this bill, but I want to just, before I start through my testimony, which, as you remember very accurately from Mr. Dean's, has a lot to do with facilities and living in Minnesota and how to confront educational issues that come forward to school districts in a timely manner. We do believe that this provision would increase costs at the local level for school districts. School districts are presently required to publish notification in the newspaper and alert taxpayers when we conduct these bonds. Also, election fraud is certainly charges that can be brought against a school district and a school district clerk going forward.
But somebody's got some cellular phone or iPad or something is on, disrupting the system here.
This bill would severely restrict the district's ability to set elections to coincide with construction schedules and enrollment needs. Elections only held in November, the school district could not begin a construction project until late in the next spring after the ground has thawed and road restrictions are lifted. The election is held earlier in the year. The district can bring begin excavations earlier and can construct the project over the winter months. Any construction delays cost money. If the election could only be held in November, it would not allow school districts to address emergency situations or situations of a rapidly changing nature. For instance, buildings that are damaged, buildings that are in need of repair to accommodate fire marshal orders, buildings needed to be accommodated for major mold issues, new housing developments that would require a new school district. And I just want the committee to reflect on the Rushford-Peterson situation. That would have to go in front of the voters. They mentioned that when they were here and their struggles. You saw what the school district was facing at the local level. This would impact when they asked the voters also. In a rapidly growing school district, schools need to be constructed to accommodate increasing enrollment. Eden Prairie, Osseo, Rosemont, it was necessary to build new schools every year to accommodate their increasing or changing enrollments. Many districts face those same pressures today. If a bond issue failed and could not be held for another year, it would be at least an 18-month delay in beginning construction, and perhaps a 3-year delay before the project was completed. In the meantime, students would have to go elsewhere. Renting mobile units is not a good solution, and it is extraordinarily expensive, even if possible. District's additional money as a result of inflation and rising construction costs make this bill difficult. The school district would be required to increase the size of the bond issued to address the increasing costs and would have to pay additional interest on that increasing cost for the next 20 years or more. In the end, Madam Chairman, we appreciate Senator Ortman bringing this issue forward. It's good to review why school districts do go to the voters, but I want to also alert you that cities and counties can do bonding efforts without going to the voters. So it's a hurdle districts have to go to ask their public if they feel it's an appropriate request. And last, if not least, I'll go back and take a look at the chart I printed out. It would have been much better in color because you could have seen the red and the blue. But I did the quick math in the back, and it 23 of these passed this year and 14 failed. With that, Madam Chairman, I'll be happy to answer questions.
Well, Ms. Kelleher, it looks like the predominance of them were held on the general election day. Just kind of interesting. On November 8th.
Yes, no. And Madam Chair, we just supplied you the whole list so you could see the list for this year.
But it's capital. It's not operating.
Right.
Are there any questions of Ms. Kelleher? Ms. Dozlin?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dozlin. I represent the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials. They're the school district finance directors and central office staff. Like the School Boards Association, we have concerns and are opposed to Senate File 2471. Should this legislation pass, it would provide school districts with numerous challenges in meeting critical capital needs. We believe that in addition to creating challenges, We also believe that there may be some unintended consequences. For instance, it may cause districts to lose out on lower interest rates, and it also will delay badly needed projects. Also, just to kind of reiterate to you, and the state law requires districts to go through extensive planning and NDE approval, as well as requiring districts to provide numerous opportunities for public input from the voters. And just, I got some feedback from some business managers throughout the state this week after I saw the bill was going to be heard. And just a couple of things to address, specifically the reference of the school district that Senator Ortman talked about. I don't know what school district it is, but here's an example I think that might address that. Many districts often do their best to put together a reasonable bond proposal and present it to voters, and it's narrowly defeated. Often through that process, after the defeat of a referendum, by communicating with the voters about the proposal, the district learns what parts of the proposal were the most and least acceptable to voters. So after that first election, and through the work of more communication with their voters, they are able to go back and in 3 months or 6 months and ask for the voters to approve the bond referendum again, and it is approved. So, again, delaying until the next general election would delay a badly needed capital project, but the process also allows for good public input by the voters. And then just another specific example, just this past fall, there was a school district in central Minnesota that had a boiler that was in very critical state of disrepair. The district had been working with their engineers, and the engineers warned them that waiting too long could be very dangerous, and that replacing the old boiler with a new, more efficient boiler would require placing most of the air handling equipment in that school. That requires extensive work in every room in the school, so it can only be done in the summer months. It was too late. This was in the fall. It was too late to hold a bond referendum on November of 2011, but the district was able to schedule the election for April 3rd, 2012, which is a few weeks away. If the voters approve the bond election, the work can be done this summer and be finished by the time of the school year. If this law were to go into effect, they would have to wait until November of 2012. Then they would have to wait the following summer to do the work. So, again, it would delay a very critical project that would need to be done in the school district. And so that's why we have those concerns. And we certainly would like to continue working with Senator Ortman on this issue.
Madam Chair, just a few comments in response. When the voters are asked what their position is on a referendum, it seems to me that we should be respectful of the results, as much so if it passes and the projects begin as if it had failed, and the school district should take note of that and there should be consequences. I would think a year waiting period before they can go back to the voters is a very reasonable thing to do. There have to be consequences, and it should mean something when voters step forward and say no to an initiative. Now, I've heard the testimony here today that the school districts believe that there might be rapidly changing circumstances that need to be responded to. Frankly, I don't credit that very much, because if your facilities are crumbling, you've known for a while. That's not a surprise. If your demographics are growing, that's not normally something that happens overnight. With proper planning, these school districts can prepare for and plan for seeking voter approval. And if they don't get it, it shouldn't mean that they should just keep trying until they get it. It means that they should wait a year, work on the proposal, and come back and ask the voters again. And so I think asking that they plan properly for the funding of these programs, asking that they consult with the voters on a reasonable time frame that suits the voters as well as the school district, and a proper balance between them, is very important. And I would hope that the committee would support this legislation.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair, I just was wondering, if this bill moves forward, I assume it will have to go to local government and elections? Is that the plan?
I think there was suggested that we send it to taxes, but
Well, Madam Chair, I have not heard that there is another chair out there that is looking for review of this bill. It really is education finance question. So I have not heard that there are any other committees that want to hear it, but I'm not opposed to sending them there.
The elections occur now. It's just a matter of timing.
Well, Madam Chair.
Correct.
I'm not sure what you are on local government, but what kinds
it's
of
it's the local
are.
Government and elections committee, Madam Chair, and I think that since it does involve a change in timing to the elections, and I think Senator Ortman raised some good issues, a valid concern about the way that school district elections are conducted now in the case of absentee ballots, that it should go to the local government election committee. I don't care if it goes after tax committee, but it should go there at some point.
Madam Chair, I've not, but I don't have any objection to sending this bill to local government and elections. I think there are some important voter integrity questions here, and I think we can address them there.
Is this bill, where is it in the House process?
Madam Chair, I don't know. I wish I knew that. Okay. I don't know.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Nunn,
to the extent that it matters, I would see this as a money bill. It would affect both levies and aids based on the assumptions that are built into the forecast. Okay. So it's not affected by the first deadline, if that's the issue.
All right.
Good.
Yeah, you're right. It does affect our revenue and our finances.
Madam Chair? Not to muddy the waters, but if we've finished our discussion on this part of the bill, I would like to offer the A1 amendment. And if I could ask Ms. Kelleher to address the committee. This bill actually has the thing it has in common with Senator Ortman's bill is where it's placed in the statute. It does not address her bill in regards to elections, but it does address an issue that was recently brought to my attention regarding what appears to be a statute in current law that applies to two entities in the state that have exceptions from them. However, with the 2010 census, Rochester would fall under this statute, as well as smaller districts around Rochester. So I'd like to maybe ask, if it's all right, Madam Chair, to ask Ms. Kelleher to address why this amendment would be necessary.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. I want to thank Senator Nelson for bringing this forward. This came to our attention Wednesday night as an issue, and it came out of a request from Stuartville, which is a small school district around Rochester. With the census of the cities of the first class, if there are lands included in the city boundary that belong to the school district, they are then also considered a school district of the first class. So Stuartville was basically trying to do their net debt calculation. And because the city of Rochester became a city of the first class, it was impacted. Until this statute is changed, Stuartville, because it is considered now part of the school district of the first class, will be unable to issue new debt maturing more than 2 years out. In Stuartville's case, their legal debt maximum drops from $122 million to $5 million. So they believe that by this deletion of this statute of two words, it will take care of Stuartville and Byron and move them back to the net debt limits that works for all school districts around the state of 15% of actual market value. This statute presently only, it was written about, only on its face works with St. Paul and Duluth. So this has been, it's been 40 years since any community has crossed over into the school districts of the first class. So this has not been a real issue. And this statute, Section 5, has stood sort of silent with no one ever using it at all. And by Rochester's ascension into this class, these two small school districts get impacted. And for your reference, members, Byron is one of the school districts that receives the least amount of per pupil funding from around the state. So they could really use this help and support. And once again, please forgive us for bringing this to you late. Until they did the Stuartville that calculation. They didn't realize what they were dealing with.
Madam Chair. This issue came up last year when I was being hounded by Senator Nelson about the fact that Manchester had become a city of first class.
Senator Olson told me there was a problem. I just didn't understand what it was.
I never did get, and I think we need Senate Council here, so grab the three main cities of the first class have school districts that I think are coterminous with those boundaries. The Minneapolis School District is in the city of Minneapolis. So it's St. Paul, and I believe Duluth is the same. They're the only three. Now, I was said Rochester is not just Rochester. It's
true.
Got additional areas. So I am not aware of a law about that is called, there are special laws for Minneapolis and St. Paul and Duluth for cities of the first class. But I'm not aware, they're individual. I'm not aware of any special categorization of districts that are not wholly within that city of the first class as called school districts of the first class. So I'd like to know what that statute is, because perhaps that's where we need to be dealing with it, rather than picking one exception, one exception for one bonding. Maybe we need to do this as a stopgap, but I think we need to get that clarified.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Nolan.
I might be able to assist on that. We have an overall statute in Chapter 475 that governs the overall level of debt that school districts are able to undertake. And it's been adjusted by the tax base changes from last year, but it's a little bit higher than 15%. If you look in the statute, you'll see that it's 15%, but then it gets adjusted based on the ratios that we recalculated last year based on the tax base changes. And all school districts must live within that constraint, except school districts that are wholly or partially, based on this statute, located within a city of the first class. So what Ms. Kelleher has identified is that there are a couple of districts that, based on the peculiarities of when Rochester became a city of the first class, get affected by this statute. So I think that by making this change, if that's your inclination, you would adjust it for those smaller districts that happen to have part of their physical boundary as part of a city of the first class.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question. Maybe someone more knowledgeable than I can answer this. But Senator Nelson was telling me that this provision in law applies to cities of first class, which as a practical matter is just St. Paul and Duluth. I don't know why Minneapolis is excluded. But then that St. Paul and Duluth got exemptions from the law, so the law doesn't apply to anybody except Rochester.
Exactly.
So why don't we just repeal the whole law?
That would be fine.
Madam Chair and members, I think one of the things that happens...
The consequences of that.
It's an interesting conversation for you all to wrestle with. In the past, there have been occasions where the law has been not withstood when Minneapolis and St. Paul have are beginning to bump up into the limit. So this committee, I think the last time it wrestled with the question, struggling, I think it was around 2008, where we not withstood it for Minneapolis. And I'm not positive I've got that right, but it's in session law.
They have the higher debt. So they have the 15?
Indeed.
And the rest of the state has 7?
No, Madam Chair, the rest of the state has that 15% as well. The question becomes, does Minneapolis have to have, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth have to have that as well? And we notwithstand that, we have not withstood it in the past for the purposes of those cities of the first class.
So how does Byron and Stuartville, how are they affected?
Because, Madam Chair, Madam Chair and members, if you look at the SCS 2471A-1, that's the statute in question. Because there is some coterminous physical boundary of these smaller school districts that slop into the Rochester city limits, and because Rochester has now been made a city of the first class by virtue of their growth, it now affects those smaller school districts because Byron has land that's part of Rochester.
As
It affects them in what way?
It affects them that they now no longer have the 15% limit, but instead have this 0.7% limit of, I believe it's
market value.
Madam Chair, again, I really thank the committee and the author for being patient with this. It did just come up, and my inclination would be, while it appears that the whole statute could be struck because it certainly doesn't apply to anyone, unless we don't act on this, it, with such a short amount of time, I would maybe prefer that we just do the simple striking of the two words, or partly, and then maybe have the committee have a longer hearing, and then really debate about should we get rid of this statute in total. But for the emergency measure, I would suggest, although certainly I would suggest we just strike the two words, or partly, in the current statute.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I have a question that Eric Naumann might be able to answer. Can you give me just a short history lesson of why it would go from 15% down to 0.7%, such a drastic change just by a little bit of increased population? Seems like it's drastic. And secondly, in the Minneapolis, or in the St. Paul and Duluth situations, in their special conditions, is it struck completely so they go back to 15, or is it something in between?
Madam Chair and Senator DeCryf, it's a great question. Why 0.7% versus 15%? And it's because in this particular example, we're looking at the market value tax base. And then the other example, we're looking at 15% of the adjusted net tax capacity. So they're two different tax bases that are going to affect school districts differently. But for whatever reason, the legislature in its wisdom chose to make one market value calculation for this statute, the one that we have in the amendment, and we use adjusted net tax capacity in the other, so the percentages are different. Members may recall when we talked about the cooperative facilities grant, we talked about that 607% limit, and that was also an estimated market value calculation relative to the other calculation, which was made on market value. So it's two separate tax bases, which give you kind of funky numbers that's a bad word, maybe disjointed numbers to the eye.
Is that clear? Is that clear as the muddy waters that Senator Nelson was trying not to create? Senator Cruz.
Well, Senator DeCryf actually beat me to the question. I had the exact same question if we had someone who could offer maybe a little bit historical perspective on it. But you know, I guess I would kind of hope moving forward, you know, we catch these things occasionally where maybe we have a statute that's ineffective or outdated. And I mean, I would hope that we would take the opportunity to act on that if at all possible. It doesn't seem like there would be any reason not to take that statute out completely if no school districts are subject to it.
Mr. Naumann, could you just clarify for us which of our referendums are on net tax capacity versus market value?
Madam Chair and members, the simple way to do that is to talk about which ones are on the referendum market value. And that's the operating referendum, the equity portion of general education, the equity levy, is on referendum market value and transition. Pretty much everything else is on the adjusted net tax capacity.
There's some thought that this might have been in trying to protect a city that had high commercial property values from getting overtaxed on some of these things. Could that have been a rationale for this done?
Yeah, I'm sure I speculate to think about what happened before I was here, and this statute precedes me by a long distance. It's a different tax base and thus a different calculation.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have any insight with regard to why you'd go from one
type of tax base to the other, but it does make sense to me that, first of all, I support the or partly deletion, but it does make sense to me to protect those big school districts from being able to have too heavy of a referendum commitment, because if they were able to do it on the same percentage basis as the smaller cities and the smaller communities, they could carry some pretty hefty referendums. So it seems to me that it's a, I don't know if it has to be done in this way, but it seems to me there ought to be a limit for those cities of the first class in terms of how much debt they can take on in a school district. So I like having a limit, and I would be hesitant to get rid of the whole thing without knowing would there be other provisions in law that would protect the people in those communities from taking on too much debt. So that's why I would prefer to just delete and strike, as Senator Nelson did, the or partly.
Discussion, or
Madam Chair and members, Peg Larson, representing Rochester School District. Just for your comfort, and maybe not Senator Bonoff's comfort, there is a bill coming forth to strike the entire statute. I believe Senator Centrum is going to be carrying it here in the Senate, and it is on behalf of Rochester, who at once becoming a city of the first class realized that they had this limit. Yes. Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you.
I would like to, at some point, get that clarified, where that statute is that links. You know, okay. If there's no further discussion, all in favor of the amendment to the A1 amendment to Senate File 2471, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Is there any further discussion on the bill?
Madam Chair and members, Sam Walsup with the Minnesota Rural Education Association. And not to belabor the discussion, but I do want to bring a third element into this debate, which is that this body has given authority to a handful of districts through alternative facilities bonding authority to issue bonds and take care of school facility needs. And those are primarily the larger districts in the metro area. And we do believe that the discussion you just had on Chapter 475 is the taxpayer protection that districts can't exceed a certain amount of total debt for the districts. And we believe that once a voting base has decided to build a facility, and that should remain at the voter level to build a new building, but once they've committed to building that building, that their elected representatives on that school board should be allowed to take care of the ongoing maintenance and facility needs for the existing facilities. And in rural Minnesota, we do have to go for that vote to even get bonding authority to do the maintenance and upgrades of existing facilities. We think that's something that needs to be addressed long-term. And so no one can doubt Senator Orban's tenacity as an advocate for taxpayer rights. She's here every day for that. But we do believe that our smaller boards and communities out in rural Minnesota should have some flexibility when they can go for those votes to get the dollars they need for to maintain those buildings. And so we do have some concerns with the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Is there any further discussion? There may well be, as you consider this further, some type of exception process, just the way we've had with those districts that are statutory operating debt. There may be some extenuating circumstances where it might be allowed to be differently, and you may want to look into that.
Madam Chair, I welcome your recommendation, and I'd like to talk with you more about that if there's some way to do that. I'm not trying to put any school district in a difficult circumstances. I just think that the interests of the voters and the taxpayers should come first, and that government should serve the people and not the other way around. I think this is a fundamental provision that says when the voters are invited to participate in these elections, that we're looking for voter turnout and participation in these decisions, and that when they've made that decision, then it is meaningful and there are consequences, as there would be on the opposite side. So.
Thank you. We're ready to vote. There's somebody who would like to move this bill?
So moved.
Senator Nelson moves that Senate file 2471 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the tax committee, and I think do you want to send it to local government, or would you like to check that out, and it could be either redirected from the floor or from your committee.
Madam Chair, I didn't object to Senator Sieben's, you know, concerns, so I would say let's move it to the Local Government and Elections Committee, and then if the chair doesn't think he needs to hear it, then we'll make a motion and move it back to the Tax Committee. But I want to honor her request.
Okay. So it will be referred to the Local Government and Elections Committee. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I think this brings us to the end of our agenda for today. We will be meeting on Monday. So enjoy your weekend.